A quick note before we start the show, this is your last chance to make a gift to PRI's The World and have it matched thanks to Newsmatch. Your support makes our work possible. Visit theworld.org/match to make your gift today. Thanks for your support. A sign of progress or abandonment today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Reports that President Trump has decided to pull thousands of U.S. troops from Afghanistan is baffling to Afghans.
They say, so this decision must have been taken based on a progress, but we do not see a progress. Situation is terrible and literally in every province of Afghanistan.
And this retired U.S. Army officer thinks a withdrawal would be shameful after so many years of U.S. commitment to Afghanistan.
We are on a path of abandoning the people of Afghanistan.
Also, who's next at the Pentagon after Defense Secretary Jim Mattis leaves in February?
It feels like it could be anybody's guess.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. One way or another, we're going to get a wall. Those words offered by a defiant President Trump today at the White House as a government shutdown loomed. Trump said it's up to the Democrats to decide now. Either they choose border security on his terms or the government will shut down tonight at midnight. More on that in a few minutes. First, though, we want to dig into a major foreign policy shift this week. The decision by Trump to pull U.S. troops not just out of Syria, but also out of Afghanistan. The administration has reportedly ordered the military to start withdrawing 7,000 American troops. That's about half the number of U.S. forces in Afghanistan. Afghan officials were said to be taken by surprise. And don't forget, this is all happening as talks with the Taliban are underway. Shoaib Sharifi is following all of this carefully. He's the Kabul bureau chief for our partners at the BBC.
The media and local people I talked to in Kabul today, they are asking why and how. Although the number is not significant, but they're saying, so this decision must have been taken based on a progress, but we do not see a progress. Situation is terrible and literally in every province of Afghanistan.
So what does it mean for day-to-day life in Kabul, in Afghanistan, if half of these U.S. troops leave, like 7,000 troops packing up and going? What's that going to imply?
Marco, I just came from northern Afghanistan where I visited a front line and also a place where people experience fighting every day. I didn't see that the news would have affected the mood of already troubled people in those areas, because we had over 160,000 forces in Afghanistan and the casualty rate of Afghan security forces were already high. So the 7,000 could not even blanket a province, but the political message has worried people rather than the military, physical military presence on the ground. So I would say overall, people haven't been worried on the ground as the numbers, but the Afghan security forces are heavily relying on U.S. air power. If that follows reduction in air power for the Afghan security forces, that will be really alarming. That will affect the morale of Afghan security forces.
Is there a sense of betrayal amongst the Afghan National Army?
Not yet. It's too early to judge that. But yeah, amongst the Afghan officials, they didn't like it to learn from the media about this surprise announcement of reduction from their closest ally, the Americans. If that's only a signal somehow to calm down the Taliban and send a positive signal that U.S. is prepared to meet their demand of a full withdrawal from Afghanistan, and that would mean Taliban reducing fighting, that could be interpreted as something positive. But their ally, the Afghan government, didn't like it, was surprised and worried that what comes next.
So you were just up in the north, as you said. You're saying the Taliban, even in the winter, when their usual kind of holiday time off, pause from fighting, they are active today.
Indeed, I visited a front line that the commander I talked to, an Afghan local police, said they engaged the Taliban every single day. He told me he lost 50 soldiers in the last few weeks, and he was saying that the Taliban are on the upbeat highest pace of fighting, just like their summer operations.
That's the BBC's Shoaib Sharifi in Kabul. So the Taliban is on the offensive, and Afghans have to continue the fight against the Taliban with or without the help of the United States. But wars are not won or lost by soldiers alone. There are also the policymakers. Andrew Basevich is a retired U.S. Army officer, and he teaches international relations at Boston University. We called him up today to get his take on President Trump apparently taking a step toward withdrawal from Afghanistan.
2 points, I think. And the first one is, let us keep in mind that President Trump has a record of making bold statements that he subsequently retreats from. So we've got a bold statement of pulling U.S. troops out of Syria, another one of reducing the U.S. troops' strength in Afghanistan. I think it very much remains to be seen whether or not he's going to follow through on this, especially given the amount of opposition that is developing from the foreign policy establishment. The second point has to do with, even if he follows through, what comes next? You know, he ran for the presidency proclaiming that U.S. wars in the Middle East are misguided. I agree with that sentiment, but there is a need for a policy that looks beyond simply getting out. We've made a mess. We have a responsibility to try to fix the mess. That requires a policy, and simply withdrawing U.S. forces is not a policy.
Well, Trump also has a record of saying things and then they actually happen, from the Paris Climate Agreement to the Iran nuclear deal and getting out of both of those to deregulation of a bunch of things on the environment.
That's true. No, I mean, it is a mixed record, and it may well be that he will follow through on this. But the fact that the Syria decision led directly to the resignation of Secretary of Defense Mattis, I think, is indicative of the extent to which the establishment is going to push back against this.
What do you
make Maybe on this occasion, he'll hold firm. Frankly, I'm waiting to see how things develop.
And what do you make of the process, a process that has apparently ignored the Pentagon, the Afghans, and our coalition partners, or anything except what the president's gut tells him to do?
Well, I think, this is the Trump style. And your use of the word process, I think, is exactly right. In general, with previous administrations, there is a process that culminates in the president making a decision. There are consultations, there's meetings, there's staff papers, there's the assessment of alternatives, there's an attempt to divine consequences. This guy doesn't believe in that. This guy thinks that he can go with his gut and that is going to provide the basis for sound outcomes. I have my doubts. I have real doubts about whether the process is informed by the prevailing assumptions of the foreign policy establishment. I doubt that they lead to sound policy, but I'm equally doubtful that a go-with-your-gut president who frankly doesn't know much about foreign policy, I'm doubtful that that's going to lead to positive outcomes.
What do you think is America's moral obligation here?
Well, that's an excellent question, and it's a question that's very difficult to provide a sort of a 15-second answer to. And we do have a profound moral obligation to Afghans and to Iraqis and to Syrians and to Kurds. And the list goes on. We can take the list all the way back to a moral obligation to the people of South Vietnam. The truth is that despite all of our talk about values being an essential component of U.S. policy, in practice, values really constitute little more than frosting. And when values get in the way of decisions, then values are discarded. And I think that regardless of what Trump is deciding with regard to U.S. troop strengths, yes, we are on a path of abandoning the people of Afghanistan after this longest and most unsuccessful war in our history. And once we have abandoned them, then the people of the United States will forget about Afghanistan in about a millisecond. I say that with sadness and regret. I think it's shameful, but I also think that describes the American people in our attitude toward these difficult circumstances.
Andrew Basevich, professor of international relations at Boston University. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Demand for a wall on the U.S. southern border is making it look like we're heading for a shutdown. President Trump says he won't sign off on a budget unless it includes $5 billion for that wall.
One way or the other, we're going to get a wall. We're going to get a barrier. We're going to get anything you want to name it. You can name it anything you want. But we cannot let what's been going on in this country over the last 10 years, we just can't let it happen.
That was Trump today in the Oval Office. Democrats are not backing down, though, so we are now just hours away from a partial government shutdown. The World's Jason Margolis has been following all of this. Where are we at now, Jason?
Confusion, blame, anger, uncertainty.
That whole range of emotions. Yeah, if the federal government shuts down tonight, what does that mean exactly?
So most of the government is still open for business. We're talking about 9 federal agencies, Department of State, Agriculture, Interior, the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, to name a few. So what does that mean? So again, there's a lot of uncertainty. So national parks probably going to be closed. Maybe the bathrooms will be closed. We don't know exactly. The IRS probably won't be functioning because tax season is a few months away. Maybe you can get a passport and a visa. Maybe you can't. Depends on what building that service is provided in. A lot of confusion.
And heading into the holidays, the Department of Agriculture, will meat be inspected?
That is also that some inspectors won't be coming to work. Again, a lot of unknowns.
Probably lots of people also tangentially affected by some furloughs right in the middle of the holidays. Do people who get furloughed, do they get paid? Is it a paid vacation?
So technically, they do not get paid. However, when this has happened in the past, Congress has reinstated their pay and they have gotten their paychecks.
What about the border? What happens with Customs and Border Protection?
Those workers have to report to work. So they're considered essential. They have to go to work. It's like 98% of them have to report for work. However, it really saps morale. I mean, you're working, but you're not getting a paycheck. They will get paid eventually, but you know, this is the holiday season. Maybe it'll be delayed by a few weeks, a few months, however long this goes.
Yeah. And we are in this game of brinksmanship precisely because of this demand for a wall by the White House. You've been to the border several times, Jason, have seen the existing wall. Just remind us, what is there?
So the border with Mexico is 1,933 miles, and that crosses California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas. It goes through deserts, mountains, rivers. We already have about 650 miles of wall. And that most of that got approved under President George W. Bush. That was passed overwhelmingly by the Senate, 80 to 19. That was just a few years ago. So there was bipartisan support for that.
Under Trump, there have been some tenders put out for new designs. A few prototypes have been developed. I've also been to the border, and some of those physical barriers are already pretty hard to get over or through, right?
They are very difficult. However, when I was at the Rio Grande Valley, which is the southeast corner of Texas,
right,
I saw a bunch of ladders. So people would just take these wooden ladders. They would hop on over the wall, and some people tunnel underneath. So it's not a foolproof system. And just to illustrate that, listen to this clip from Representative Tim Ryan, a Democrat from Ohio.
I'm for border security, but I'm not for a wall. You know what? I like cars, too. I'm for cars. I'm not for the Model T. You guys are living in the past. And this government is in chaos.
Now, Ryan, who is also a possible presidential contender, reminded President Trump of one of his key campaign promises and was kind of mocking him.
And who's going to pay for that wall? And you remember all your fans would stand up and they, Mexico's going to pay for that wall. Who? Mexico.
Yeah, well, Donald Trump said last week in his meeting with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, I am proud to shut down the government for border security. I will be the one to shut it down. I'm not going to blame you, the Democrats. So if we're going to assign blame for this, who gets it?
Oh, well, that comment was days ago, Marco. Today he tweeted, the president tweeted, quote, the Democrats now own the shutdown, exclamation point, end quote.
The World's Jason Margolis. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The Ministry of Silly Walks. Monty Python. Upper Class Twit of the Year. Monty Python. The Dull Men's Club. Not Monty Python. It's an actual thing. And no, it's not just for men. The BBC's Mariana DeForge spoke to club members from all over the globe.
Respectable, boring, semi-retired. This is the voice of Grover Click. He's in charge of the Dull Men's Club. He's not the president, though.
You got to remember, it's the second mouse that gets the cheese.
To join the Dull Men's Club, you need to also have a passion for something very ordinary, mundane or boring. Some members collect lawnmowers, others enjoy watching paint dry. Genuinely. For Grover, it's park benches.
I can go anywhere in the world and enjoy where I am if I just have a park bench to sit on. I call Central Park the park bench capital of the world. They got such a wonderful array of park benches.
The Dull Men's Club has just reached 30,000 members and counting on their Facebook group. They have a community online, they meet up in person to share their hobbies, and even have a calendar that features members from all over the world.
I'm Tim Barker and I live in Cumbria, and I get my excitement from collecting and appreciating toy soldiers.
My name is Rainer Bless. I live in Berlin, Germany. I am German, which should be dull enough, but my dull hobby is studying maps. Geographical maps and atlases, political maps during elections, even fictional maps like Tolkien's Middle-earth.
This is Lee Maxwell. I'm from Eaton, Colorado, and my hobby is collect and restore antique washing machines and the history thereof.
Why do you like them so much?
Well, they're just fascinating.
I am Elisabeth Blanchet. I am at the moment in Marseille, in the south of France, and I've got a dull obsession. I'm obsessed with post-war prefabs, little bungalows.
Some members are younger than you might imagine.
My name is Alistair. I'm 25 and from London, and I'm a numismatic, which means that I collect coins from around the world. Doesn't mean I'm that rich, though. And I'm a proud member of the Dull Men's Club.
The club was started by Grover over 30 years ago.
We began in the mid-1980s when I was living in New York City. I belonged to a club called the New York Athletic Club, and we'd been to the gym, and then we were down in the bar area afterwards, and the monthly magazine of the club had come out. And within the magazine, there are articles about clubs within the club. There's a boxing club, a judo club, a wrestling club, a fencing club. And one of the guys at the table there, one of my mates there, said, "Gee, we don't do any of that stuff." Someone else said, "Yeah, we're kind of dull." So I said, "Well, let's start a page for the Dull Men's Club and just write about dull things we do."
One of the things that they wrote about was weather watching, a favorite pastime of the newly formed Dull Men's Club.
We like to watch weather forecasts. We'd get together early in the morning at the club and watch the weather forecasts. Then we'd pick up the phone and call around the country to see if it was really happening that way.
But if you're after something a little more exciting than checking up on the weather, member Amanda Hone's supposedly dull hobby doesn't sound actually that dull at all.
My passion is following brown tourist signs.
Stay with me.
Brown signs are truly international. Basically, signs on roads and motorways that showed people the direction to kind of tourist destinations, really. But that included like beaches and theme parks and lots of different things.
Even Mount Everest has its own brown sign. Amanda thinks following them is one of the best ways to see a country.
I think there's a lot to be said for just going off on your own and, you know, putting down anything that might influence you and just be inspired by the things that make you go, "Ooh, what's that?"
Where's the furthest you followed a brown sign to?
Probably Japan, to be honest, the furthest away from here.
And how many brown signs have you followed now?
I honestly don't know. It's hundreds, if not thousands, because it's everywhere I go. I follow a different brown tourist sign, and that includes all over the world.
And the Dull Men's Club, did you join or did they contact you?
Yeah, they contacted me. And the reason why they contacted me, because it was the first year that they had let women in. So I'm triumphant. So that was, I don't know whether it was last year or the year before, but I was Miss January in their calendar. A privilege indeed, right?
I asked Grover, the man in charge of the club, why he's brought all these people together and what it is that he enjoys so much about running the club.
When we look at these people that are in our book and calendars, I kind of wonder what makes them tick. And there's some common threads run throughout. And one of them is they get a thrill with what they're doing every time they do it. You might call the interest quirky passions. Interest in something that is very common and ordinary, mundane, far from the glitz and glam, but they get great pleasure from it. There can be beheadings, there can be political problems in your various countries and all kinds of bad news, and they can just retreat to their hobby and be content doing that.
There's something admirable about being so passionate and fascinated by something, even if it is milk bottles or manhole covers. And every member of the club that I spoke with was proud to be called Dull. The Dull Men's Club is a celebration of finding happiness in the simple things. And for those who are inducted, being in the Dull Men's Club is nothing short of an honor.
Curious, their story didn't bore me at all. The BBC's Mariana DeForge there, along with the members of the Dull Men's Club, men and women, from all over the world. All right, this is about somebody who's definitely not dull. Did you think Santa was from the North Pole? Think again.
It's a local misunderstanding that Santa is from North Pole because he has the office there. But the problem with the North Pole is that there's nothing that the reindeers can eat.
Ilkka Lankinen runs a few Christmas businesses in Rovaniemi. That's the official Santa Claus village in Finland. Think of it as a Santa amusement park with elves, reindeer, shops, and restaurants. As you can imagine, it's a busy season.
Well, today, actually yesterday, we had a charity charter from Ireland with a bunch of children. Basically, most of them are terminal ill, but they wanted to see Santa, so they came to see...
The Santa Village draws more than 600,000 visitors a year, with charities and guests from all over the world, especially children. And if they can't visit Finnish Father Christmas, they send him letters. Lots of them.
Here, in the Santa Claus post office, we spend a lot of time to arrange and read through the thousands and thousands of letters that children around the world sent to me.
And that guy, he claims he's Santa. But Rovaniemi wasn't always Santa Claus's village. It actually started as a quiet trading town in the 1930s. And in World War II, it completely burned down. Rovaniemi needed to be rebuilt from the ground up, and it was with the help of a Finnish architect. His name was Alvar Aalto. Here's Lankinen again.
Alvar Aalto was designing many buildings here in Rovaniemi, also the town hall, the city library, and he actually drew the first set of the reindeer or area plan, and yes, you can still find it in the city structure.
Yeah, that's correct. Rovaniemi was rebuilt into a reindeer-shaped street grid. And I think you can guess who moved in next.
So remember to be good. Merry Christmas.
Father Christmas himself.
Bye-bye.
We were speaking with Ilkka Lankinen, the founder of Pro Santa, one of the companies in Rovaniemi, the Santa Claus village of Finland. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. Hey there, listeners. This is your last chance to make a gift to PRI's The World and have your donation matched dollar for dollar thanks to Newsmatch. Contributions from listeners like you make our work possible, from the international reporting assignments and correspondents on the ground to the studio equipment that makes this show happen every day. You value the world, so I hope you'll make a gift today at theworld.org/match. That's theworld.org/match. And thanks very much for your support. I'm Marco Werman. The Ukrainian capital, Kiev, is known for both relatively cheap tech talent and cybercrime. So here's some expert advice.
If you're a tech company and you're setting up an office there, that's a place where you should think, you know, long and hard about what kind of data you're sending there and who you're sharing it with.
That story still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The changeover doesn't happen officially until February, but the news that Jim Mattis is resigning as Secretary of Defense is huge. He rebuked Trump's foreign policy in his resignation letter. Mattis was also respected by lawmakers from both sides of the aisle. The cabinet position of U.S. Defense Secretary has big implications for how American foreign policy plays out. So who's going to replace the retired three-star Marine Corps general? I talked to Dave Brown, defense editor at Politico. He told me that the list of possible successors for Mattis is short.
You know, in the early going, it feels like it could be anybody's guess because a lot of the names that were thrown around before Trump decided to nominate Jim Mattis are people who, if you look at the past 2 years, have actually come out against a lot of the Trump policies. Senator Tom Cotton's often named as a possible Secretary of Defense. Another possibility could be Jim Mattis's deputy, Patrick Shanahan.
Then you've got retired Army General Jack Keane. He's a frequent commentator on Fox News. Senator Lindsey Graham as well. So let me just go through some of these names, and you tell me if they're a top pick. You know, use green light for top pick, yellow light for maybe, and red for it's not going to happen. So Senator sure. Tom Cotton, green, yellow, or red?
I would say yellow. A war veteran who's been aligned with a lot of the things that the Trump administration has said over the past 2 years. However, he's joined a lot of other Republican senators condemning the decision to pull troops out of Syria. And he was green until some of this criticism.
Lindsey Graham.
And there's another one. All you had to see was his reaction to the Trump administration's decision with respect to Saudi Arabia and the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. He was one of the absolute most vocal critics of the White House's stance. And as soon as the news came out that we would be pulling our troops out of Syria, Lindsey Graham said, hey, every time Trump tweets about Syria, I'm going to tweet him back and tell him why he's wrong. So it's almost overnight how he's gone from green to red.
Wow. And then retired Army General Jack Keane.
Another one who's always at the top of the list. If you read the Woodward book, President Trump offered him the Secretary of Defense job first. And General Keane said, nope, but you got to try this guy Mattis. And General Keane was interviewed about this last night and said he's not interested. So he's yet another person that you could take off the list.
What about Patrick Shanahan, the Deputy Defense Secretary?
He could be a green. He's got a very, very different resume than Secretary Mattis does. A former Boeing executive. But one thing that's really marked his tenure as the number two at the Pentagon is he has been the main booster for Trump's Space Force. He's visited the White House many times. He's forged a closer relationship with the president and with Vice President Pence. So is it possible that Trump could be looking for someone who doesn't have that heavy military experience, someone who hails from the corporate world, willing to follow through vocally with a lot of these policies? He could be a green.
Do you think, Dave, that as we kind of understand what Trump is as a president, his policies and what he's doing, do you think more and more people are just kind of walking away and like, I'm not going to work in this White House?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And, you know, you could almost imagine a replay of what happened with John Kelly, where Trump has his heir apparent or he has a shortlist. One by one, they say no because they decide that whether you're the chief of staff or whether you're the Secretary of Defense or one of these other positions, you're put in an almost impossible position. Just about everybody who has the necessary national security credentials is saying that the president is wrong. And they have all, in their own ways, large and small, taken themselves out of the running. And you have to wonder who would want to take this job.
Are there any names you're especially worried about? Like, could any of the top contenders significantly change U.S. policy or weaken ties with allies?
Well, I think the thing that would worry people, and that's both Americans and allies, is someone who would blindly follow what the president wants to do. And that's across the board. That's treatment of transgender service members. That's throwing a parade, pulling troops out of war zones. That's sending troops to the border. You name any of the policy areas where the president has made a pronouncement and Secretary Mattis has done whatever he could to soften or make it palatable for the establishment. So I think the thing that would worry people is someone who doesn't do that.
Dave Brown, the defense editor for Politico, speaking with us from just outside of Washington. Thanks very much, Dave.
All right, you take care.
Whoever comes next as defense secretary will have to deal with that other decision by President Trump, the one we heard about earlier, to reduce U.S. forces in Afghanistan by half.
So what was your reaction when you heard this news?
To be very honest, after Trump election, there was a lot of speculation around it. So it was not a total surprise.
That's Awashma Farooq. She's an Afghan women's rights activist. And she's been speaking with my colleague, the world's Shirin Jafari. I'll let Shirin pick it up from here.
To Awashma Farooq, it was inevitable that one day the U.S. would pack up and leave. but she never imagined it would come at a moment like this.
Right now, talks with the Taliban are ongoing. We didn't expect that the U.S. administration, the U.S. president, will give the Taliban such a big leverage.
In recent months, peace talks between American representatives and the Taliban have been gaining momentum. It's an intricate dance, getting two sides that have fought each other tooth and nail for decades to sit down and talk peace. The Taliban have long demanded that foreign troops leave Afghanistan before they agree to any deal. Now, Farooq says, the U.S. has granted them that wish without getting anything in return.
I talked with a lot of my family members, everybody since yesterday, who are all very, very upset and very angry.
She says President Trump's decision to cut U.S. forces in Afghanistan by half will embolden the Taliban. The U.S. officially ended its combat operations there 4 years ago. So at least in theory, there aren't any American troops fighting on the front lines. The mission shifted to training and supporting Afghan forces. But, says Bilal Salvari, a journalist in Kabul, the Afghan military remains heavily dependent on the Americans.
The reality is that the Afghan National Security Forces, without the American Special Forces, American air support, drones, we would really find it extremely challenging.
What's also concerning to Afghans, he says, is that the Taliban remains powerful and control considerable amount of territory.
The Taliban have not backed away publicly from saying that they will stop fighting. They're saying they will stop fighting until they kick out all the foreign invading forces, including the Americans.
So he says it feels like the U.S. is dropping the ball at a crucial moment. Meanwhile, Afghan President Ashraf Ghani discounted the Taliban's reach in an interview with the BBC.
You know, this is a figment of somebody's imagination. The number of districts that actually have fallen is very small.
That doesn't reassure Rashma Farooq, the woman's rights activist. She says the U.S. pullout is a propaganda tool, not only for the Taliban, but also for Afghanistan's neighboring countries, like Iran.
It's so interesting. If you look at the media from the Iranian side, they keep telling us that, oh, we told you from the beginning, you shouldn't have trusted the U.S.
Zobeida Akbari echoed Farooq's sentiments about the U.S.'s withdrawal. She woke up to the news and immediately called up her friends and family.
It makes us shocked. It makes us sad. And also, I mean, as a woman, I feel like that the world has turned their back to us once again.
She says her biggest fear is that the Taliban will call the shots and return to their repressive rule.
I understand that a lot of lives have been lost and this war has been too long, but leaving like this abruptly compromises everything that has been gained.
U.S. forces could begin leaving Afghanistan as early as next month. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
If you're like me, this is a sound you hear when someone's at your door. And if you're like me, a small dog then starts barking his fool head off. Anyway, I'm a little behind the times, apparently. These days, doorbells are connected to the internet. They also have microphones and cameras.
Ring makes it convenient to see and speak with whomever's at your front door, anytime, from anywhere.
A marketing spot for Amazon's Ring. Maybe you know about Ring. What you probably didn't know is that footage collected by these smart doorbells has been ending up in Ukraine. Matt Drange got the scoop on the story. He's with the tech website The Information. Matt told us that since 2016, people developing Ring have been quietly working in Kyiv, the Ukrainian capital.
The area is known as a location where you can get tech talent and engineering talent relatively cheaply. And so Ring decided, okay, you know, let's open up an R&D lab there.
Right. So the R&D lab ended up in Kyiv. What else ended up there? Like customer data?
Yeah. So very quickly, within a few months, customer videos from around the world ended up there. And the reason is that, you know, the whole point of having this R&D lab is to train your algorithms so that it can tell, you know, hey, that's your dog or that's the UPS guy. And so you need data to teach your doorbell to recognize those things. And so Ring's approach was to just use customer data.
Were there security concerns about the Ring system from the beginning, and what were they?
Yes, there were security concerns from the beginning. I mean, Kyiv in particular is really seen as both a victim and a perpetrator of cybercrime, in the sense that, you know, they're right on the doorstep, obviously, of Russia. What the cyber experts that we spoke to said is that, look, if you're a tech company and you're setting up an office there, that's a place where you should think, you know, long and hard about what kind of data you're sending there and who you're sharing it with.
What do you think theoretically is the worst that could happen? I mean, these devices are connected to Wi-Fi. Could this give hackers access to other connected devices in someone's home?
Potentially, yeah. I mean, so Ring, in addition to storing user video for months, they also collect various metadata associated with the doorbell. And so from the experts that we talked to, it seems that the worst case scenario would be if your video and metadata were to be hacked and to, you know, essentially end up with in the wrong hands, that would essentially give whoever it is access to knowing when you aren't home. It's in other words, a virtual time guide of when to break into someone's home, because they know if you're leaving, you know, every day, let's say you go to work at 7:45, they know that that's a good time to come and see what's in your house.
Yeah, so the risks to privacy are pretty clear. Are you aware, though, of cases where customer information and data have been misused because of the company's operations in Ukraine?
No, so at this point, there are no instances that we know about where customer data was either hacked or misused somehow by employees.
Now, Amazon bought Ring earlier this year in February and reportedly paid more than $1 billion for the company. Have operations in Ukraine continued since the Amazon takeover?
Yes. Yes. Operations in Ukraine are largely the same for Ring. At this point, they actually have more than 500 employees. So it's a pretty large team. Mm. And the setup is still basically the same. The only difference is that now, since the Amazon acquisition, there have been some steps to try and limit access to user video. But again, as I mentioned before, you know, some of these Ukraine employees, I talked to more than two dozen current or former Ukraine Ring employees, and many of them told me that they're already finding workarounds around that.
Matt, do you think the average Ring owner knows about this?
No, I do not think the average Ring owner knows that their video is sent to Kiev, Ukraine. There's nowhere in the company's terms of service or privacy policy do they say that. You do when you sign up for Ring and agree to their terms. Essentially give Ring ownership of your video data so that they can do with it what they will, but they don't actually really tell customers, here's what we do with it. We send it to Ukraine for image recognition purposes.
What is Amazon, the owner, the new owner of Ring? What have they said about all this?
So Amazon has not commented on the story. They didn't comment before it either. So, you know, it's unclear if they're actually concerned about this. You know, some of the stuff could have been prevented or just decisions made differently early on in terms of, you know, a startup saying, hey, we need to grow and grow quickly. You know, you need to figure out, okay, how do we do that, but also in a way that will ensure that, you know, customers will trust us moving forward.
Matt Drange with the information. He co-reported a story about Ring, Amazon's smart doorbell, and the company's secretive operations in Kiev and Ukraine. Matt, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
A note here that we did reach out to Amazon's Ring. They told us they take the privacy and security of their customers' personal information, quote, extremely seriously. A short anniversary note here. 30 years ago today, this news broke.
Good evening. There's been a major air crash tonight near the Scottish border. A Pan-American jumbo jet carrying more than 250 people has crashed near the town of Lockerbie in Dumfries.
Pan Am Flight 103 took off from London, headed for New York. It was brought down by a bomb that exploded in the jet, tearing it apart, scattering wreckage across the town of Lockerbie, Scotland. Everyone on board was killed, 259 people. The crash killed 11 more people on the ground. Today, Lockerbie held a memorial service. A single bagpiper. Dignitaries and locals joined some relatives of the victims. Also there, members of the emergency services who raced to the crash scene to help that night. Most of the passengers on Flight 103 were Americans. Nicole Boulanger was one of them. She was a student flying home for Christmas. Her body was never recovered, but some of her clothing was collected and washed by local volunteers who returned them to her family in America. Nicole's mother, Janine, says she's never forgotten the kindness of the people of Lockerbie.
Sometimes we get guardian angels in life, and that certainly is an example of the love, the dedication, and the caring of a group of people in another country who didn't know our children, but who knew how much this would mean to their families.
Janine Boulanger at a memorial service for the victims of the Lockerbie bombing 30 years ago today. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. At The World, we hear from a lot of listeners, mostly brief comments, often anonymous. It can be hard to know if the stories we tell really have an impact once they come out of the radio or your earbuds. Then we got a note from a listener that talk about impact blew us away. It came from here, an elementary school a few miles down the road from us.
My name's John Rogers. I'm a proud teacher here at the Guild School in East Boston.
The Guild is a public school in a working-class neighborhood. John teaches fourth grade.
And every morning we have a meeting. We begin with a greeting. We read a quote. We share the news of the world and the news of the school. And finally, if there's time, we play a quick game.
And some of the news John shares with his class, it turns out, comes from us here at The World.
One morning, back in October, I shared a story from Brazil where...
The story was about the Amazon rainforest.
But Carlos Quesada with Brazil's National Institute for Amazonian Research says a new threat is now looming.
The forest is responding to the atmosphere.
And the atmosphere is changing.
That story came from reporter Sam Eaton, how climate change is stressing the Amazon, maybe making the forest less able to absorb CO2 pollution, and how that, in turn, might be making climate change even worse.
In other words, he says, when it comes to climate change...
The Amazon was buying you some time that it's not going to buy anymore.
So I shared that for the class. And then the next day, a poem appears on my desk.
Global Warming Poem by Ana Camille Valdez. The world is getting hotter day after day. But do we ever wonder why? This is why. Cars, buses, trains, and deforestation is messing up the air. They affect the air, and we have to remember trees help us breathe. But now the trees and the rainforest are doing the opposite.
Naturally, I felt like really impressed that a student took that initiative herself. We're heavy into a poetry unit now. But to take it upon herself to write a reflection poem that talks about global warming and standing up for the environment. And it was this beautiful poem about how we have to act now and that the future is ours and we have to make a difference.
Our future is in jeopardy, but that can all change. Let's start protecting our planet today.
The golden nugget was when the poem appeared on my desk that wasn't even the assignment. She took it upon herself, so I felt like you need to know that. You need to know how far your show reaches.
That's when John sent us a note with a picture of Anna and a copy of her poem. Thought this would make you happy, he said, and sure did. And it turns out Anna's poem was only the beginning of the story.
It was almost like a wave had begun. We all wrote global warming poems.
A Blaze of Heat by Nikki. Day after day, the world gets hotter and hotter. The air we breathe is getting bad, and all that dirty air...
But it wasn't just global warming poems. There were poems about a whole bunch of stories John and his students have heard on the show.
Dear Mother on Border, inspired by Tear Gas Caravan by Cynthia. Panic. Run from the gas. Run for your life. Run from the gas. Your freedom is waiting for you on the other side of hope.
Rags and Riches, inspired by the France Yellow Vest protest by Chad. Rags and riches, there's no in between. Rags and riches, yes sir, more taxes for me. Rags and riches, let's take things back.
This poem is about when Jamal Khashoggi died and they're still investigating who did it. Why me? Inspired by Jamal Khashoggi by Elizabeth. I can't go home, said Jamal Khashoggi. I will get arrested, but the free press is important, so I will go home. Jamal Khashoggi.
50 years on death row. Do you know how it feels like to be in jail for 50 years for doing nothing and waiting in jail to kill you?
Serious thinkers, these fourth graders, but not too serious. Being kids, a lot of them were also drawn to our story about SpongeBob SquarePants.
Hey, Wilson.
What did you write about?
I wrote about SpongeBob's global popularity
Wilson wrote this after our story about the death of SpongeBob's creator, Steven Hillenburg, and how the cartoon has been translated into more than 50 languages.
And he could turn into anything funny. SpongeBob has inspired a lot of kids to be happy.
There are a lot of happy and surprisingly hopeful kids in this class, and I was actually a little surprised that their teacher talks with his students about so many heavy stories from our show. But John Rogers says the kids can handle it.
I think that fourth grade is always a grade where they come so young and then they leave like little adults. And learning about like sad stories or sometimes scary stories, I think just like helps motivate that maturity. Yeah, and poetry I think is the perfect vehicle to have them reflect on it because it takes away some of the barriers of traditional like essay writing.
Clearly, Mr. Rogers, yeah, could his name be any more perfect? He empowers his students to take on these dark realities, which is why Anna wrote that first poem that got the whole ball rolling.
Why do you think that story about the Amazon and climate change and deforestation, why do you think it affected you so much that you wanted to write a poem?
Well, I'm also a human being, so I really care about the earth. It, like, really, like, it's mind-blowing how we just destroyed our own earth. But, like, we can still change that. It's not too late.
You know, I listen to politicians say that, and it just gets harder and harder to believe them. But I believe Anna and her classmates, and that gives me so much hope. Thanks to all the kids of Mr. Rogers' fourth grade class at the Guild Elementary School here in Boston for inspiring us, for inviting us to their school, not to mention playing Baba Mal for me, complete with disco strobe light. You are the best. And don't forget our invitation to visit us in the newsroom. By the way, besides reading us their poems, Anna and her classmates greeted me and our environment editor, Peter Thompson, with life-size posters they'd drawn of us. Those posters, along with pictures of our visit to the kids at the Guild School and a video of Anna reading her poem, are at theworld.org. Okay, I wish I had a disco strobe light with me in the studio, but I'll leave you with some music from Senegal's Baba Mal all the same. This is Sidiki, his classic from the album Fire and Futa. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Have a great weekend as you head into the holidays. We'll be here for you on Monday.
PRI, Public Radio International.